St. Helens gasped as the tall, ugly orcs appeared suddenly right in front of them. All were at least the size of the trees on both sides of their path, yet they had not just materialized or dropped an invisibility cloak, but had come walking up from the distant sea. Drops of water glistened in the sunlight on the greenish scales of Brutalus and his long, incredibly sharp-looking sword. At one glance, St. Helens could see that it was really the leader he had spoken to with Helba's crystal. In the magic communication quartz that was for him so highly reminiscent of television, the orc had appeared almost laughable in his ugliness. Of course, there had been no clue to his size, and St. Helens naturally had not thought to inquire.
St. Helens! Do you surrender unconditionally? You may surrender or die here, as is your choice.
St. Helens swallowed. Just what had he gotten himself into? He had thought the stories of the size of orcs exaggerated.
Well, you're going to reply to that?
More Crum would like to make the reply himself, St. Helens thought. Not that Crum begrudged him his leadership, but he had done his best to talk him out of this foolish mission.
We fight!
The orcs came forward, step by unhurried step, swinging their sharp, long, deadly swords.
How? Those swords of theirs can cut through trees! They're so long they can slice through us before we're in arm's length, our arm's length! How do we get within striking distance?
Catapults!
They should have time to set these up, considering the speed with which the orcs were advancing. Barely time. The rush was whacked down with swift sword blows, and the catapults wheeled up in a staggered, though imposing, line.
Fire!
St. Helens saw one of the orcs clutch his stomach where a boulder struck. He was going to whoop with joy, but at that moment, Brutalus reached high to grasp with his own two webbed hands an identical projectile. The chief of the orcs staggered from the weight and speed of the boulder, but stopped it and held it up as if it were an overlarge beach ball. To the orc, St. Helens realized with shock, the boulder was playing size and catchably light. He just had to get his balance and be ready for it.
Uh-oh.
The rock was coming back at them, hurled by the superb arm muscles of the enemy orc.
I don't think we can stop them with catapults.
Charge!
Are you crazy?
St. Helens charged all with leveled, sharp, and deadly dragon lance. That lance should account for anything living he had felt. But as he drew closer to those tree trunk legs, he was less certain. At this speed, the lance should go all the way through Brutalus' scaled middle. It should bring him down, spouting orc blood and dying. With the orc leader dead, slain at the outset, there should be some remote chance of a Confederation victory. Brutalus' great sword tip was suddenly in front of him. Just before the spear had reached it, the awful blade swung away. Then it swung back fast, catching the shaft of St. Helens' ponderous weapon. The spear head of a size to do for the largest living creature coexisting on St. Helens' earth. Brutalus, giant leader, was unperturbed. With an almost casual motion of his sword, he had rendered harmless St. Helens' single best weapon. They were back in Rottenick, having outdistanced the orcs and escaped from the kingdom of Apel. Merlane was still clutching the opal she had stolen and hadn't the slightest notion what to do with it. In fact, she was confused about what to do with herself. She had resolved not to steal anymore, yet here was the opal. How could she set that right? She didn't know, which meant she would have to follow the lead of the boys, which was no good thing. Kildee lay on his back, exhausted from his exploits. Suddenly, a large predatory insect lit on Kildee's chest. Its horrible mouth opened as it prepared to bite off the boy king's foolish head.
Charles!
Oh, thanks, Charles.
Charles nonchalantly cleaned his sword. His smug expression said what he wanted them to think. That as his father's son, he was naturally heroic, and slaying ravenous insects was all in a hero's day's work. Merlane knew better, for she could read his mind. He had been as stunned as the rest of them, but the little girl Glow had called to him, jogging him into action. Glow had almost forced his arm to grasp the sword and swing it accurately.
Glow? There's no such girl here.
Merlane strained to get her thoughts straight. There was someone they knew by that name, but...
No!
none of us will get big again. You busted the bottle when you drank. I didn't break it on purpose.
The Alice water was all gone anyway. But the pain is right. We can't any of us grow big again.
We won't need to. We've got the spelling book. We can call up the big bird to carry us all back.
I hate it. I won't call up the bird again. I won't do any more witch magic.
Well, we can walk. Or the opal. We do have the opal.
Yes?
They had been wrong to steal it, but at least the opal itself wasn't evil, as far as she knew. Not really intending anything, Merlaine stared hard at the opal. She was sitting cross-legged, with it resting in her lap. The sun beat down hotly, and the lily pad had a definite smell to it, and it made her think about the children's suite they had left an eon ago, it seemed. Her fingers stroked the smooth, cool sides of the opal. How nice it would be to be back there safe, as if all this had never happened. A fat little boy was staring at her, all big-eyed astonishment.
Look, Miss Pringle! Merlaine just appeared right out of the air! She's sitting where I threw up my chocobola!
Hush, Ebenog. That fibbing of yours has to stop.
But Miss Pringle, just look!
I haven't time. I have to read this numerology lesson.
Pointy-eared children and shapely young witches and handsome muscular warlocks were all around, busy with their concerns and not interested in this corner. Merlaine wished for the invisibility cloak. She was still cross-legged, still holding the opal between her fingers. Now that the brat had mentioned it, she could definitely feel and smell his vomit. Auntie John's face was suddenly near her own. Under her arm, she could see Ebernog with a big play ball still wide-eyed. Auntie John, or whoever this was, had popped out from an invisibility cloak.
So you got it for me, Merlaine. That's my bad girl. I knew you could do it. You have the makings of a truly malignant witch. It comes naturally to you. Give it here.
No. No, you can't have it. You said it was for Helba. Besides, you're not really Auntie John.
Now what makes you think that? Give it to me, brat.
Merlaine shied away, but strong fingers pried at hers. Her mind reached to Ebernog just as the big clawed fingers started to nip through the skin on her hands. She thought of the fat boy throwing his ball, bouncing it against her tormentor's back. An ugly old witch was revealed, grasping the back of her head where the ball had struck. This was what the imitation John was really like. This wasn't Auntie John at all, just as she had thought. This was someone whose image belonged in that spelling book. The witch, who was not Auntie John, threw an invisibility cloak over Merlaine. She disappeared herself. She was going to do something dreadful to get the opal from Merlaine. Merlaine tightened her fingers even more on the opal, so very hard they hurt. She must not give it up. She wished she was home with her mother and father. The air changed. Instead of sanitary sweet with a background of brat vomit, it was now warm and pure backwoods country with a background of animal manure and soap and a foreground of delicious. She was sitting, cross-legged, on the kitchen floor, holding the opal in her lap. Her hand still smarted where the witch's claws had stabbed her. She was still invisible. She could see right through herself and the opal to the well-scrubbed floor. Her mother was just cleaning out the scrubbing brush with the point of a knife, dropping dollops of soapy dust back into the bucket. In a moment, her mother would take the bucket aside and empty it on a bare spot away from the back door. Her mother had baked cooigs and frosted them, her favorite kind, pigel butter. Her father wasn't in sight, and neither was Charles. This was wonderful, but there was something odd about it. If her parents were here, how could they be? Merlaine got to her feet, quietly, keeping the cloak of invisibility in place. She looked out the window into her backyard. The flowers and the fence looked a bit different. But this was home. It looked like home. It smelled like home. Just why her mother was here scrubbing the floor, she didn't know. Mother should be back at the convention. Father should be too. And Helba. And of course Grandma and Granddad and Auntie John. Merlaine ran from around the side of the house. She was pursued by Charles, who caught up with her and grabbed her by a shoulder and pulled her around. Charles had mud in his hand, and he was going to wipe it on her, maybe in her lovely coppery hair. Her mother looked through Merlane and the opal and out the window.
Now, Charles, you stop that. You stop teasing your sister.
She started it. I did not. He called me old dragon poop.
No, I didn't.
Yes, you did.
I called you fat dragon poop.
Children, what am I going to do with you?
This couldn't be right. This couldn't be her home at all. This had to be one of those almost the same worlds where a Merlane and Charles were almost like her and her brother, but misbehaved. But then she and her brother did often misbehave, so that wasn't certain. Something else nagged at her, and after a moment she identified it. There had been no mental communication. It had all been verbal. Why hadn't they been thinking insults at each other instead of yelling them? Now she knew this wasn't right, and that she shouldn't be here. She didn't want to be here. Then, she found herself looking not at duplicates of Charles and herself, but at giant lily pads. The sun beat down hot, and the headless body of the giant insect was being feasted upon by reasonably sized gnats and ants. This seemed to be the place, and there was even the hole in the lily pad where Kildee's giant feet had been before he reduced to ordinary size. Everything was as it had been before she wished herself back at the children's suite. Only one thing was different. Charles and the Paynes were nowhere in sight. St. Helens pulled his horse up short and threw away the worthless half of his dragon lance. Now, all he could do was wait for that huge, merciless sword. But Brutalus did not strike. Instead, he stuck his sword in the ground so that it stood upright. He leaned down, his great hands grasping. St. Helen saw the hands approaching and tried to avoid them. He was too late. Before he could move, he was caught.
Now I've got you, St. Helens, you loudmouthed troublemaker.
Up close, his face was a formidable sight. Shark's teeth gleamed in a mouth reminiscent of a big-mouthed trass, eyes that were less attractive. St. Helens thought of drawing his sword then, useless gesture though it might be, but just then a finger as muscular as his own arm pinned his forearm to his side and scabbard.
Coward!
He couldn't even start his move. He assumed an orc expression of surprise and pain, and his fingers loosened. St. Helens dropped out from the orc's grasp. The drop might have killed him, but he landed on springy grass on his hands and knees, taking up some of the shock. St. Helens saw more crumb reaching down to him. He grabbed the hand and was hoisted up on a big war horse's broad rump.
What'd you do, Moore?
Stabbed a toe. Hang on, we're retreating.
A huge boulder zipped past. St. Helens fell off the horse and landed hard. Brutalus was coming for him at racehorse speed, not with a sword, but a large knobby club. Evidently, the orc intended to pound him down into the ground where he'd stay. He tried to rise. He couldn't. He closed his eyes for what had to be the end. Dragon Horus watched. That was Merlane's grandfather about to get his head smashed. Dragon Horus did not ponder the risks and possible consequences. Tail swishing, body wriggling lizard fashion from side to side, he charged. The man-thing stood taller than three large mere standing atop each other's backs. He smelled more fishy than human. By the time the man-thing saw him, Dragon Horus was there. He avoided the swing of the club as he would Ymir's antler, crouching low to let it pass. His teeth found the creature's ankle and bit through scales. The giant's club dropped, the foot lifted, Dragon Horus holding on and coming up with it, teeth ground against ankle bone. Dragon Horus, sensing the giant's hand, grabbed for his tail. The dragon's tail was one of his main weapons, as the orc should have been aware. Anyone who tried to grab it was asking for trouble. Horus smacked the hand with his tail. Dragon Horus had had enough of this. The big thing wasn't going to come down, so he was going up. Horus started foot climbing a scaly leg. There it was at last, the throat, bordered by two great gills covered with scales as thick as tree bark. Lovely. Horus dug in, ripping off scales. He opened his mouth, ready for the big, satisfying, life-taking bite. Hands pushed him away. A big head came down as the hands held him out at arm's length. A mouth opened, revealing teeth as long and pointed as an adult dragon's. Horus strained. The orc strained. Something was going to have to give sometime.
There's another, Charles!
Kildy pointed wildly at the approaching giant insect. How many did this make? Charles had slain so many that he had lost count. The fish were feeding well now, courtesy of his sword. It seemed to be divinely guided. Every time a predator came in for the kill, a kinglet or glow screamed warning, and he reacted almost automatically, guided by her sight.
Glow?
He was a hero now, in every sense. And with every chop of his sword and every bounce of a downed insect, he was wishing that it were not so.
Charles! There!
He swung hard at the head and thorax of a needle-shaped creature Kildy said was a fly dragon.
More!
There were more. Three, no, four of the creatures. If only there was some way of escaping them, some place to hide, some place at least that he could rest his back against. The giant flower on the next pad. They could take refuge in its bell, and there it would be easy to keep the insects from crawling inside. What a wonderful thought. Wonderful that he, unlike certain royalty, had brains.
No, Charles!
Who was that calling mentally to him? Not Merlaine. She had disappeared with the opal. Someone he knew. If only he could see her. If only he could remember. But right now, he was too busy saving his hide. He leaped to the adjoining pad.
Kildy! Kill them! Come! Charles, wait!
Charles ran as fast as he could to the flower and climbed its waxy bell. Once inside, he'd challenge any bugs.
Wait! 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 Wait!
What was the matter with him?
Uh-oh.
The flower petal moved like a tongue. Charles slipped. He fell inside the bell and slid downward. Great stamen shook above him, bringing down a sticky yellow powder. The inside of the flower was dewy with crystal drops.
Here, Charles.
Gratefully, he took the pain's hand.
No!
Kildy, help!
Kildim succumbed to undulating motions of the petals and came down on top of Charles. The face of Kildy appeared where Kildim had come from. Kildy threw up his hands and somersaulted off the edge down onto them, then on past into the depths of the flower. Charles and Kildim were pulled down to where Kildy lay downward and stuck. Charles tried to move an arm and then a leg. He was stuck now, really stuck. He should have heeded Glow's warning. If only he could remember who she was and why he cared about her. Around them, in the dim radiance of the flower bowl, numerous insects were stuck, as they were, around the flower's stamen. Some were living, some dead, but it was evident that this hardly mattered. None would escape.
Well, Charles, that was dumb. Don't you know an eaten lily when you see one?
I do now.
Just then, Glow appeared, with a fragment of her dream world behind her.
Oh, Charles, I'm so sorry.
I should have listened to you.
But help is coming, maybe. In a while, I think.
Until then, can we play together?
Until then.
She took his hand. Merlaine wondered, was this the right frame? It seemed to be, but how could she be sure? The opal had, after all, taken her to a wrong frame when she left the convention. But then she had thought of her house and yard and her mother and Charles all together, and that couldn't be done in her home frame. What was the poor opal to do except take her to where these existed? This time she had wished for the frame and place she had left. That was important. Frame and place, and maybe time, too, to give the opal accurate instructions. So it should be right. But where were the boys then? Where? A flower on a nearby pad took her attention. It was the size of a small house, and it was vibrating. The bell of the flower was so large, and the way it was shaking. She had never seen a flower do that. Could there be something living inside the flower? Maybe the boys? But if that was the case, why didn't they come out? Well, might as well see. She leaped over to the adjoining pad and approached the flower carrying the opal. She wouldn't want to drop the opal.
Charles!
Merlane?
He seemed to be waking from a dream. Glow was just leaving and being forgotten.
Don't come close to the flower! It's dangerous!
So you are in there. Come out!
Can't. Sticky stuff. Kildim says we'll be digested like the big insects.
You've got your sword?
Stuck like glue. So is my arm.
What are you doing in there, anyhow?
Swarm of insects. Big insects. Seemed a safe place, only it wasn't.
Dumb. Which pain thought of it?
Neither one. It was my dumb idea. They tried to stop me and they fell in too. Don't come any closer.
You want to be digested?
No, but at least you can escape.
Then I'll get some help. I have the opal and now I know how to use it. I can go back to the convention and...
No, Kildy says there's no time. They'll keep you there and question you and not believe you're not fibbing, and by the time you get someone to listen to you, we'll all be eaten.
But...
Kildim says the opal will teleport you to anywhere you want to go. In this frame, not just out of it. Go get someone who knows about these flowers, fast!
Yes! Yes, I will!
Who could she go to? Some adult. Grandfather St. Helens would know. Grandfather St. Helens claimed to know everything. And he was too ornery to do things the sensible adult way. He might actually listen to her. Just like that, she was there. But her hope of help was no closer to realization. Grandfather St. Helens lay on the ground, and there was Uncle Lester's big father on a big horse. And there, just a little way from both of them, so close they might get stepped on, was the Orc King, Brutalus. He was holding something out at arm's length that was all wriggles and copper color. Something alive.
Oh no!
For what Brutalus held was her very dear other brother. Dragon Horus and the Orc both busily snapping their teeth at each other. St. Helens didn't know whether to believe his eyes. Had he taken a blow to the head when falling? That couldn't be his cute little six-year-old granddaughter who had just appeared here on this battlefield. Yet it certainly looked like her.
Brutalus, you let him go! Horus, you behave yourself!
The dragon dropped from the Orc's grasp, lit on his feet, and ran to her. Her little arms reached out as if to a beloved pet. Copper-scaled, pony-sized dragon, coppery-haired girl joyfully met, and the child hugged the monster, and the monster's tongue licked the child.
Merlane! You've got the opal! Give it here!
Merlane was busy wiping greenish and reddish blood from Horus's dragon face. She was using a piece of filthy but once purple-colored blouse. She seemed quite uninterested in the outstretched hand.
Merlane, give the opal to your grandpa.
Are you hurt, Grandfather Volcano?
No.
St. Helens stood up, surprised to discover that he really wasn't.
I'm not hurt, but the opal...
I need it.
Merlane took hold of Dragon Horus's very small and quite unusable wings and put one cherubic but ungirlishly dirty little leg over the coppery monster's head. She was straddling its neck region. Her face came down until she rested her small chin directly above the dragon's brow. She paused, now glancing at Brutalus.
I know it's your opal, Your Majesty, and I'm sorry we stole it, and I'll give it back to you, honest. But right now, I just have to have it to save my brother and friends.
Then, she spoke to the dragon, who had been quiet while she bestrode him.
Stay with me, Horus.
She held the opal in front of her, seeming to caress it. Suddenly, she and the dragon weren't there. The only sign remaining of their presence was one drop of dragon's blood and two of orc's blood on the flattened grass. Brutalus and St. Helens looked at each other, similarly bemused. For the moment, comrades in astonishment. Merlane and Dragon Horus were on the giant lily pad facing the pad with a huge flower.
Charles?
Here, Merlane.
Charles,
I brought Dragon Horus.
You brought our brother? Why? What good can he do?
I don't know, Charles. But you know how dragons are. Strong. Besides that, Horus is smart.
Don't waste time, Merlaine. Our skins are burning and our clothes are crumbling.
I won't.
She turned to the dragon.
Horus, Charles, and two of our friends are in the flower. They can't get out. Can you help? Please help.
Horus crawled up to the big white flower and sniffed it.
Careful, Horus. Don't let it hurt you.
Horus's thought was a reassuring tongue flick that Merlaine knew was his signal for affection, or anger, or understanding. Horus wriggled up to the flower and tried a deep, hard bit on the outside of the bowl.
I don't think it likes that, Horus. Oh, but look! All you made is closing up.
Dragon Horus levered himself up to a dropping petal at the top of the bowl. He peered down inside. Dragon Horus was pulled partially inside by a sudden suction. His front claws dug into the flower, and he hung there, his head barely visible to her, the rest of his body inside the bowl. Now she understood how the boys could have gotten trapped. That flower had some tricky mechanisms.
Merlaine, Dragon Horus's tail is just above my face.
Well, grab onto it, Charles.
I can't. It's too sticky in here. I can't move my arm far enough. We're stuck. I think his tail is stuck, too.
Dragon Horus, do something.
Horus seemed to try to pull himself up, straining where his claws held the petal. He was strong. He began to come up out of it, dragging the side of the bowl into a wrinkle. Suddenly, the great bell, the entire flower, in fact, shook and vibrated.
Merlaine, he's beating up the inside of the flower. Skin's tearing in here. Insects are shaking loose.
Well, you want out, don't you?
Merlaine, I'm loose. The glue isn't holding. Horus's tail is whipping it into froth. Kildee and Kildee are loose.
Good enough. Stop it, Horus. You have overcome the flower. They want out.
The beating stopped. The flower quivered and its petals drooped. It had been defeated.
Merlaine, I've got hold of his tail now.
Then climb out.
Merlaine fidgeted until her brother and then the royal pains emerged from the bell. They were all well slimed, filthy with pollen, and with insect parts stuck to them. Some of their skin had turned red and was peeling as if from sunburn. Dragon Horus waited until they had dropped to the pad, then pulled his tail free, dropped, bounced, and rebounded. Stuck to his formidable tail were great patches of cream-colored flower skin.
Oh, the poor flower. I didn't want you to hurt it.
Of course not. Why should anyone want to hurt a flower just because it was going to eat your brother?
Well, that's its nature. You have your nature. The pains... Excuse me, I mean the royals, have theirs. Horus has his, I have mine. All the poor flowers wanted was a meal. Are you boys hurt?
We'll recover. Eaten lilies take their time.
Oh, I'm so glad.
You still wish to invade Opal, Commander Riley?
St. Helen shook his head, glancing at Moore, and wishing he was elsewhere.
I'd like to call it quits, though I haven't the authority to surrender. All I want are the children.
We do not have the children, as you now know. They not only invaded Opal by themselves and destroyed a landmark and a sea mark, they did other damage as well.
I'm certain the Confederation will pay. It's only right.
And they have stolen Opal's greatest treasure.
The orc leader put down his big knobby club. He drew his huge sword from the ground where he had stabbed it, brushed off its shiny blade with a scaled hand, and resheathed it at his side.
The girl said she would return the opal. But how can we depend on the word of a child?
It wasn't an official act. If we can settle this matter without fighting, I...
Without your being destroyed.
It's a matter for heads of state. I'm only a an officer.
You may not be for long. I am the sovereign ruler of Opal, and I demand a face-to-face meeting with the rulers of the Confederation who stole our jewel.
That can probably be arranged. Boys will be boys, Your Highness.
Orcs will be orcs, Commander, especially when crossed. Your Confederation has 3 days to make all right. If nothing is done by the end of that time, I will invade with all the orcs that are necessary. Arpel will have satisfaction, one way or another.
St. Helens believed him. King Rufford raised a hand above the viewing crystal Helba had left him and listened to the words Brutalus had spoken. He brought his hand down in a slashing motion, blanking the crystal as effectively as if he had made the proper pass. He stood alone in the silence of his private room in the palace, considering what he had just seen in the polished hunk of crystalline rock. The facets, acting magically now, reflected back his own heavy features with particular emphasis on the nose that would have looked equally well on a comedian or village drunk.
So, St. Helens, so, round-eared temperamental friend, you'd negotiate if you could, wouldn't you? Even you can see that as warfare goes, you have met more than the Confederation's match.
King Rufford, formerly King of Rudd, now just a mere figurehead, looked out the window onto some flower beds and a bright day. It wouldn't be so pretty here if the orcs conquered. Nothing in his original kingdom would ever again be the same. Orcs were ugly creatures, tall and reputedly brutal. He knew nothing about them except the legends he'd heard as a child. Witches were almost as strange, though he had been married to one. Would Helba and the missing Kildim and Kildee do the right thing for the Confederation? He believed they would. Yet there was so much he didn't know about them. Isolationism had totally disappeared since the advent of the prophesied Round Ear. Would Lester Crumb fulfill the mission he had gone on? Would he get to the witches' convention and talk to Helba? What about the Round Ear and his magic gauntlets? Truly, potential history, or was it history in process, was a great uncertainty. He hoped Helba and the Round Ear would soon return, and that the two of them could and would clear up the mess and salvage something. Who would have thought that innocent children could cause such mischief?
Wasn't the little dragon cute?
Fenibly massaged Brutalus' hurt hand, magicking it into wholeness. She had started with his throat, where the nasty beast had ripped off scales.
Cute? Cute is hardly the word.
Oh, but it is. All coppery and bright. And the most remarkable thing is that it's from the same spawning as the Tads.
Wonderful. But if those Confederation creatures don't make things right, we're going to have a war. We have to have our opal back.
Not really. Not with our superior intelligence.
That's not enough without the opal. We need it to jump around and behind the enemy forces. Without it, we'll have to move on land only by foot.
Oh, I forgot about that. I can conjure you and individual troops back here to me and return you to your army there, but that won't do you much good in a combat situation.
Yes. Female, are you going to help us fight while we're stuck afoot, or are you going to cry over those pests?
You won't ask me to hurt them.
No, but we have to defend ourselves. If the humans want a fight, we'll give them a fight. We have before. Even without using the opal.
With Hermandy? But now it's almost all the rest. Only Throod and Rotternick are not involved, and Throod will probably provide mercenaries.
I'm certain your magic will be superior to anything they can throw against us, wife.
Merlaine saw the big ugly bird first. It had the appearance of the witch who had pretended to be Auntie John and had shown her true form finally at the convention. Had that mean witch followed her here? Not quite sure why she did it. Merlaine whipped off her cloak and threw it over Dragon Horus. As happened with invisibility cloaks, it seemed to stretch over him. She looked to the sky and saw the bird coming fast.
What'd you do that for?
The boys were sitting cross-legged, studying the books they had. They had been engrossed in the ugly pictures of the spelling book and had not seen the bird.
Get under there, and Horus is back. Stay there until I tell you.
Horus, stay hidden. Keep them hidden.
Something in her voice caused the kinglets to obey. Not a word of painish argument escaped their lips. They scrambled under, their faces turning ghastly pale as she pulled the cloak across and drew it taut on their backs and heads.
Be still!
A moment later, a great ugly swoosh lit in front of her. Immediately, It turned into the horrible old witch with a bad breath, ghastly pale complexion, and assorted hairy warts.
Give me the opal.
No, I won't! Charles?
Zadie wanted to laugh. This idiot child thought to confront the most powerful malignant witch in any of the frames with a mere sword? A mock sword at that. One whose magic he did not understand and which wouldn't do him any good anyway. What a farce.
Now, Horace! Now!
Zadie turned to see a small coppery dragon bearing down on her in a burst of speed. Just then, an unwatched foot kicked her ankle, hurting her and causing her to delay her magic. The dragon's tail swooshed, striking her across the chest and face.
Hurry!
The kinglets threw off the cloak of invisibility. They had remained covered, though Dragon Horace hadn't. Now the cloak whipped away from them on a gust of wind, and they knew there would be no recovering it.
We've got to get out of here!
Why? She's dumb.
We don't know that. You know how strong she is. Witches can survive almost anything.
I know that, Merlaine, but your dragon brother and I finished her.
Come!
Reluctantly, staring into the water, Kildee dropped off the dragon's back. Merlaine took his place and motioned frantically to the others. In a moment, Charles and Kildee were behind her, and she was on the head of the dragon with the opal.
Well, stupid, you want to stay?
Kildee was annoyed by her attitude, but decided that this was not quite the time to set her straight about the prerogatives of kings. She wanted him mounted, so he mounted.
You certain this will work? All of us, one opal?
Shut up! My sister has to concentrate.
I mean, they're sure to take it away from us. Even though Kildorm and I boss everything, including you, Helba thinks we're children.
Brats.
Yes, she thinks we're brats, but...
I meant you! Shut up! She can't do anything while you're yakking.
Well, I want to go exploring. I'd like to see that three-headed thing that aided your father and affected your birth.
The chimera? You'd faint on sight of it.
Maybe, but maybe you'd faint yourself.
Before they even realized it, they were in some sort of garden. Everything smelled green. Back a distance was a castle. Standing before them, looking down, not at all disturbed by their presence, was a large, coppery-scaled creature whose body resembled that of a Scorpio crab, complete with a long copper sting. One of its heads was that of a warrior. A second head was that of a beautiful coppery-haired woman wearing copper earrings. Between the two human heads was a coppery dragon's head several times as large as Horace's. The three heads came down on long, scaly necks, examining the visitors from three sets of coppery yellow eyes. The eyes of the woman head blinked, and her eyebrows arched.
Merlaine, Charles, Horace, why has it taken you so long to visit your godparent? And who are these inferior mortal creatures? Their minds are as incapable of mind-to-mind communication as your father's.
Merlaine swallowed an opal-sized lump. So this was the head she had been named after. Morvania.
Good! Now we get delicate meat.
The twin kinglets were petrified. If Morvania didn't allow Merton and Grumpus their culinary wishes, it was going to be an interesting visit.
And so, my friends...
Helba spoke to the assembled witches and warlocks from the podium.
That's why we are going to need your help. Lester here says that the war with the orcs has already started. We know the folly of that. With the opal, the orcs can go anywhere and get any number of reinforcements. Nor are they devoid of magic. Though they are a standoffish lot who never attend our conventions, even if we all pledge our help, the outcome is uncertain.
A young warlock with a somewhat villainous expression stood.
Helba, we all admire you for what you did to rid the frames of Zoanna and Roforth. We'd all like to help, but it seems to me that the trouble in your home frame is chronic. Why should we, with our own frames to think about, risk everything?
If not for the joy of aiding a colleague and preserving her domain, than for the opal.
Opal? The opal?
Yes, that one. When this is all over, we can hold it in common property and use it whenever there's trouble.
That's all very well, Helba, if we could win, but the probability is that we cannot. The orcs will get all the reinforcements they need from other frames and counter magic with magic, force with force. The result could be a lifeless frame when you're done.
We can use the opal as the orcs use it once we have it. Then no outside force could prevail against us.
We don't have it, and never will.
Pessimist.
But she looked around the audience and saw that most were of the warlock's opinion.
Sit down. Now I am going to tell all of you what you haven't considered. The orcs are my confederation's opponents in war, true. But the orcs are not the real enemy. It's the same situation as when Kelvinia declared war against Klingland and Kantz. The enemy then was Zoanna and Roforth. The enemy now is Zadie. Dare I suggest to you what that means? Yes, Zadie, the most malignant of the practitioners of malignant magic. Zadie, who violates not only my home frame, but who came here and violated this very convention. How many of you have had your property taken? How many have felt kicks and pinches, been tripped, and suffered even worse indignities? How many of you have been spied upon or forced into actions you did not intend? How many of you like one lone malignant taking over our convention and making it a shambles?
We're with you, Helba! Death to Zadie! Death to Zadie! Extinction to our evil kind!
Wait, wait! Zadie's in jail here. You caught her, Helba.
I'm afraid not.
A uniformed officer strode onto the stage.
I've come here to make an announcement. Zadie, it seems, has again done the impossible. She has escaped from confinement and also from this frame.
By noon, it had started. Witch after witch, warlock after warlock, was stepping into the busily flashing transporter. The line led back across the station and curled past the baggage area. Other lines at the other transporters were noticeably absent. Every conventioneer, it seemed, whether apprentice or adept, youth or ancient, was going to Helba's frame to bolster her army. Lester Crumb watched them proceed with open mouth. The line moved slowly, because there was only one utilizable destination transporter, and that one was underwater. He turned to Kelvin and to his pointed ear and round ear relatives.
You and your father and Helen have to use the other transporter?
You know the warning in the home installation. Helba wouldn't let any of us risk ignoring it.
Only round ears can use it. I never understood why John thinks it's nonsense.
I don't think it's nonsense. I've seen too much magic and science that was anything but bluff. Anyway, why take a chance?
Right. You'll wait until we're all gone?
Have to. Unless you want someone turning you into a bird.
No! That I don't want.
Oh, Lester, it'll be fun. You'll enjoy it.
No, I won't, because I won't do it. I don't want you birding it either.
Oh, poo. Lester, I've done it before.
I still don't like it.
You take good care of my mother and sister. Father and Helen and I want to be up above the pointed ear installation in the rowboat, just in case you really won't change.
I won't.
Kelvin stepped out of the home transporter, put Helen down with relief, and looked around for his father.
What's the matter, Kelvin?
John Knight had crossed to look out the chamber door. He turned and came back.
Boat still there?
All's as before.
Except for those.
Helen was pointing to the stand and its familiar parchment warning that only round ears were allowed here and signed by Muvar. Beside the parchment was another that had not been there before. Beside that one was a pair of boots whose leather sheen exactly matched that of the magical gauntlets. Kelvin hastened to look, as did his father. The new parchment read simply,
"You will need these, prophesied round ear, Muvar.
Muvar? He knew we'd be here?
Precog. He was here before. Must have been. Either that, or someone else sent us to the Chimera.
Kelvin remembered in a flash their inexplicable journey to the Chimera's world, caused by a change of the settings. He had thought it was the doings of the terrible king of the Silver World, Rofirth, who had outwardly so resembled their King Rufirt. But possibly, just possibly, it had been Muvar who reset the transporter. What a notion. It suggested that Muvar, instead of being long out of things, remained active to some extent.
Don't look at me. It's your boot size. You're the round ear Muvar prophesied, not me.
Yes, I'm the hero.
Your boots are a bit worn. Try these on.
Kelvin knew that there was no help for it. Sitting down on the metal floor beneath the strange lights of the chamber, he drew off his old boots, adjusted his socks, and pulled on the new boots. He expected them to be stiff and uncomfortable and to chafe, because that was the nature of new boots. But these felt very comfortable, as if he had worn them all his life. How could Muvar have known his size so accurately?
They look fine. I wonder if they do anything, or whether this was merely a sartorial favor.
If they protect my feet, it's enough.
We'd best be getting out. Your mother and sister may be taking to the air already. Lester too, I suspect.
Kelvin nodded and thought of the ledge and the boat as he took his first step, leading off with the right boot. He felt no sensation of motion, but his seeing blurred and things came back into focus only as he finished taking the step.
Kelvin!
To his astonishment, Kelvin stood exactly where he had visualized going, right on the ledge above the boat. His father and wife quickly emerged from the cylindrical chamber with its round door. John was shaking his head, his mouth open with amazement.
Well, now we know what they are, son. 7-league boots, as in the storybooks. That's on Earth. The story you and John learned was about distance-spanning boots. Otherwise, it's much the same.
Kelvin thought back to his childhood, and to the more recent but stranger childhood of his offspring. Spanner boots. It was what his father had said was teleportation, or something. Magical transport across great distances without having to ride a dragon or enter a transporter booth. It did seem like a better way to travel.
With those and your gauntlets, you should be a match for Brutalus or any orc, I think. That must be the move our plan. Maybe we don't need the benign army. Maybe you really are enough of a hero to handle this all by yourself.
Do you think they'll take me to other frames as well?
That strikes me as a damn good question, son. Try visualizing yourself back at the hotel desk.
Kelvin, don't!
It's all right, Helm. I'm a hero, I think. Muvar wouldn't leave me anything destructive.
He thought of the polished wooden desk and the hotel manager who had registered them. He nerved himself and took a step. He looked. He was one step closer to his father. Maybe the manager wasn't there right now. Maybe he should just think of the floor and the desk. He did so and stepped again. He was another step closer to his father. Maybe he should just think of the transporter booth in the station. His next step, he told himself, would take them just outside that booth. He stepped and looked up at his father.
I guess they won't transport me across frames.
Try stepping out to the palace ruins.
Kelvin thought of the large rock where John Knight and King Rufirt had once played chess. He took the step. Emerging from the hole in the ruins were three swooshes, flying wingtip to wingtip. The swooshes lit by Kelvin and changed immediately to his mother, his sister, and Lester Crumb.
Ooh. Kelvin, how'd you get here? New boots.
Kelvin stepped back to his father and Helen on the ledge. He swallowed, shook his head, and motioned at the boat.
I'll row, father. Might as well put the gauntlets to work.
Kelvin rowed the boat to the stairs, and then he, his father, and Helen met up with the rest of the party. Kelvin explained about his new boots.
And you think you can really fight the orcs with those and the gauntlets?
I can try if I have to.
Where's Helba?
Here I am.
Helba stepped out from behind Lester.
And I see that there are matters all of us are going to have to settle.
Kelvin felt an unheroic plummeting inside. Did this mean that her expectations were like those of his father? that with this new gift from Muvar, he could do all the gory orc fighting without magical or military help?
Oh, stop it, Kelvin. I know you haven't any liking for war. That's good. None of us have either. That's why we're benigns. Well, Kelvin?
Well, what?
Wool gathering again. Boys, they never listen to anything.
You tell them, Elba. They never listen to me either.
Just what, Mr. Heroic Roundeer of Prophecy, are your immediate plans and orders?
These are our friends, Kildim and Kildi. Kings of Klingland and Kant and now rulers of the Confederacy.
Oh, I know that, for pity's sake. I can see into their minds readily enough. Where do you think you got your telepathic abilities, if not from me?
Us.
Yes, from me, meaning this body with three heads.
Merlaine opened and closed her mouth.
Don't! Don't! I want to be my mother and father's. I don't want to be the child of a monster.
Ungrateful brat! Without my help, you three wouldn't exist.
Yes, I know. The magic powder Helba administered at our birth. But before that...
Before my antidote, there was another powder derived from parts of one of my kind. That was administered to your mother, Helm, through the connivance of Zoanna, the Witch Queen of Rudd, destroyed by your father with the help of Helba and her helpers, your grandmother and aunt.
Then we're not even yours! We're some other monsters!
Hush! That's not a nice thing to say. Of course you're not ours, and you're not, as you so meanly put it, some other monsters.
But...
You're your parents. Your own parents, Kelm and Helvin.
No, that's Helm and Kelvin.
Whatever. Human seed.
But if that's so...
Magic. And not even very complicated magic. I'm surprised you weren't taught.
I was taught. I can read a little and write a little and everything.
You and Dragon Horace. Merlaine, you were taught nothing. You've got a very extraordinary mind for an inferior life form.
Inferior life form? Daddy said you called him that.
And your grandfather. And the uncle you've never met. Humans are inferior to my kind. Oh, and to a lot of kinds.
You take that back!
Facts are facts, kid.
Take it easy, Merlaine. Can't you see she's baiting you?
The two young kings looked at each other with completely open mouths. It was as if they had both been rendered mute and idiots. It was just too comical. Then she had to put her fists down and look away from the beautiful woman face to the face of the stern, copper-helmeted warrior.
Merton, does Mervania always tease like that?
Always. Toys with our food is what she does. When she meets human men, she hides her body and just shows her face and tries to make the men think she has breasts and things and they get all excited and think there's a big romance in the offing. They're not really surprised when we eat them. But now, at least since your father's visit, she doesn't let us eat. You would really taste good, Merlaine, as a human child should.
Oh, now, Merton, you know we won't eat our own godchildren. Not unless they get really disrespectful.
Merlaine wondered. Was it that they wouldn't eat godchildren, whatever they were, or that they wouldn't eat fellow monsters? Was she and Charles, and maybe even Dragon Horace, going to be like them someday?
Silly child. You certainly did inherit your father's obtuseness. Of course none of you will be like us. All you got from my powder was life and the ability to use your minds. From Zoanna's tampering, you have your dragon brother and just a touch of dormant, malicious nature that her aunt Zadie preyed upon.
You know about Zadie?
You didn't block me from your mind. Not that you could, of course.
Merlaine wondered how she could have been so dumb. And after having heard her grandfather tell the story over and over and over, the Chimera had not only known their thoughts, but all the notions that made up their thoughts. Thus, Mervania had teased her father on first meeting by showing just her neck and head, and hinting at a stunning human woman body, as Merton had mentioned, and forcing him to remember scary stories from earliest boyhood. Kelvin hadn't remembered well at all, though his father and half-brother certainly had. Yet the Chimera had looked into Kelvin's mind and read it so thoroughly that she remembered for him.
That's right. You reason well for such a little girl.
I have to. I'm smart.
For a you-know-what.
Yes.
She wouldn't. She absolutely wouldn't think inferior life form.
But you just did.
Mean, snoopy old copperhead!
Mean? I haven't hurt you, have I?
Teasing. Teasing hurts.
But it's oh so amusing to me, godchild.
Yes, Daddy said that it was.
Then, she remembered something else. That though her father talked of the Chimera's teasing, he also talked as if he had some affection for Mervania's head. It was because she was so very, very beautiful, as Merlaine knew she was herself. Men were always stupid about beautiful women, as her father and grandfather had been, even when they knew that there was no good in those women.
Why, thank you, Merlaine. But you needn't try to conceal your thoughts. If you had thought them right at me, I wouldn't have balked. Yes, I am beautiful, by your father's standards. With your coppery-colored hair and eyes, you may one day be beautiful as well.
I am now.
No, that's your vanity. Vanity can be a tremendous asset to a woman, but it has to be grounded in reality. When you're all grown up, then you'll be beautiful. Now you're merely cute.
Cute?
As a kippy or a pupkin. An amusing little animal that has a lot of growing up to do. If you're permitted to grow up, as I doubt your witch enemy intends.
Merlaine shivered. The others were looking at her in wonder. Charles knew what was going on, but poor Kildim and Kildy could only conjecture. True, the Kinglings knew about the Chimera and were smart, but there was no way they could talk to each other with just their minds. As far as Kildim and Kildy were concerned, she was just standing there making faces while the beautiful woman's face above her now and then changed expressions.
Please speak aloud so that all of us can hear.
Oh, very well, but it's so slow and tedious. Don't you and Charles ever tire of having to make animal noises for every little word?
It's our way.
Yes, yes, you are secretive. Your father wasn't very much, though he tried to be when he was here. You and Charles just mind talk when it's convenient.
Yes.
I know that. You don't have to agree aloud when it's obvious.
I do at home.
Well, you're not home. Do as I do here.
I'll try.
You will. There's no sense in your not doing it. You do, after all, have the gift bestowed on you through my agency at your birth. Slow thinking shouldn't exist in you. Now, about that opal.
Yes, I want it.
You can't have it.
Why can't I?
You're confined. You'd use it to leave here.
Suppose I say I wouldn't.
We wouldn't believe you.
You're a monster after all.
Brat, the word of my kind is never broken.
That's not what I heard.
Well, kid, if you feel that way.
A sudden swoop of the Chimera's feminine arm stopped at Merlaine's clenched hands.
Please?
There was no way of resisting her. Merlaine was powerless to keep possession of the opal. She started to place the gem in the waiting hand.
Ow!
Mervania drew back her hand. Horace flipped back his tail, having delivered a really proper whiplash.
Merlaine, get us back!
Scared, more urgent than she had ever been, Merlaine grasped the overgrown pebble and thought home.